Welcome to the Idea Pod, a podcast dedicated to exploring and interrogating professional biomedical and applied ethics here at the University of Leeds. Hi everyone, thank you for joining today. I'm Gabby. For any new listeners, I am one of the hosts and a postgraduate researcher in AI and data ethics at the Idea Center. In this episode, we're going to take a look at some data privacy issues and cybersecurity that have arisen or have been amplified by the limitations imposed by the COVID-19 pandemic. Joining me today, we have a special guest, Andrew Dyson, Global Co-Chair of DLA Piper's Data Protection, Privacy and Security Group and Managing Partner here at Leeds. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you, Gabby. It's a pleasure.
So just so our audience has an idea of why you are our special guest, why don't you tell us a little bit about your role at DLA Piper?
Indeed. So I lead our data protection and cyber practice, and I've been working in the field of data protection for over 20 years now. And for many of those years, data protection was a little bit of an esoteric subject, but it's become, particularly with the GDPR and cyber breaches and various other things that have been happening over the last 5 or 10 years, it's become much more front and center of practice for us. And it's given me the opportunity to work with a very wide range of organizations, right through from sort of tech startups through very large corporates, banks, insurance companies, and actually some government agencies as well. So a real mix across both in the UK and internationally. So looking at things like global airlines and hotel companies as well. So we sort of see a real range of organizations all dealing ultimately with the issues of capturing, analyzing, sharing data and the risks that come with that, both from a privacy perspective. And we look a lot around the kind of issues of data protection and privacy, which are regulated in many different ways in different countries, but increasingly also people effectively attacking systems and extracting data, which could then be put to malicious use and the impact that that has for businesses, again, from a legal and a regulatory perspective. So we do get to see a broad range of issues with particularly new technologies coming out as well and the kind of the risks that they give rise to in this space and sort of working through the impacts of those. And I think that's particularly relevant to this conversation we're going to have today.
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, this is great. We basically have an expert on these issues. And so the two main topics we're going to discuss today have to do with cybersecurity, trust and teleworking, and also coronavirus mobile apps. So let's start with remote working or teleworking, as some people like to call it. So just to have an idea, the problem that a lot of people complain about is that they are being forced to move, you know, and operate without testing, without planning or any type of adjustment into a remote sort of teleworking. So there are unique cybersecurity challenges. There are instances in which there is a weaker cybersecurity because they don't have any type of institutional design on any type of planning, because we're rolling with it. We're in a pandemic situation that forces us to take very quick and very prompt decisions. So one of the aims that we should be looking for is ensuring confidentiality, integrity, and availability of the company's systems and data. How do you see these issues developing in the experience you have and how you've seen it in companies struggling with it?
Sure. I mean, it's a great area to think about, because what's happened with the pandemic, of course, is that everything's been turned upside down. Most organizations have had almost no time to kind of work out how to address issues, but have kind of gone into survival mode. So I think the most sophisticated organizations have been through sort of emergency contingency planning, and in my experience are reasonably well prepared for this. And so they were able to flick a switch and get their workforce to work from home. They all lifted their laptops, they went home, and they knew how to work safely and securely from a remote environment, and they've got sort of secure logins and all their data can be accessed in a secure environment online. And there are always risks about the environment. We'll come back to that. But broadly, you know, more sophisticated companies had proper contingency planning and knew how to address this quite simply. The challenge you've got is with those organizations that have not had the opportunity to do that level of sophisticated business continuity. So they've sort of said, well, actually, we can carry on getting our business going by sending our workers to work from home if they're office based. But it might be ask someone initially at least to work from their own home PC, where they may or may not have proper authentication models to get access to the systems. They may be working in an environment in the household where other members of the family or even housemates, if you're sort of a youngish person and you're working, you may not live in a family environment. You've got other people from who are circulating around the what is now your office, and you can easily look over your shoulder and see what you're doing, or get involved in your work potentially, or see what conference calls are going on. So there's an issue there about the environment itself not being secure. Because if you think about it, when you're in an office environment, everything's being built from bottom up to be secure, to be safe. You have to swipe the card to come into the building. You have to log in with a secure password. You have to, to get access to information and data. It's all very carefully worked through. But what we're seeing now for these, these organizations who are maybe less sophisticated are, it's a bit of a bootstrap operation where they're just sort of, look, let's get on and make it work. So, yeah, having people work from their own, potentially their own infrastructure, their own iPads, their own laptops, not the work one, potentially using things like Dropbox and Google Drive and OneDrive and things like this to store documents or share information, because it's the sort of the easy way to do it where the office-based IT isn't quite up to it, making use of video conferencing facilities, which, again, we all know are easy to use, the Zooms and so on, but there are issues around well-known risks about people accessing some of these or sharing documents inappropriately where the settings haven't been properly done. So it's not that these systems are not necessarily capable of being used in a secure way, but it's the fact that people are using them without proper training, without proper understanding of the controls. And what then happens is your information assets, if you're not careful, find themselves into places that you don't expect. So as I say, in an office environment, typically it's all very locked down and very heavily controlled, and data is sort of sitting on particular servers and only accessed in certain people, with certain access rights and held in certain places, all of which is within the kind of control realm. But what's happening during the COVID situation is people are breaking down some of those boundaries just to kind of get the thing moving, get the businesses going, and not thinking through or being aware of the potential implications of effectively information assets sitting outside the secure office environment. And to some extent, we won't necessarily know the full implications of that for several months until people become aware of, that database or Excel spreadsheet, why was that sitting in that Dropbox environment, which was not necessarily properly secured, and someone's got access to it, and now it's sitting on the dark web. So all these things kind of have a long tail to them. And that's problematic. I think the other thing that we're seeing is, and there's definitely been a rise of security and data breach incidents, are the vulnerability of organizations to phishing attacks, to people. Again, because they're sort of the psychology of where people are in the current environment is different. If they get an email from what looks like their managing director say, oh, we're facing a bit of an emergency over here, we need to send funds from A to B to pay for this, your immediate instinct says, oh my God, no, we need to help the business, we need to do this, and you sort of make the payment transfer, and it may be a fraudulent payment transfer, of course, and the natural controls, the natural suspicions that we would have had pre-COVID have gone away, and so we're seeing that sort of psychological effect as well, which is creating quite a lot of vulnerability to people who are just reacting in this, as I say, survival mode, but in doing that, the natural caution and the natural guards and the controls that were historically in place are falling by the wayside. And I think the third thing that I just mentioned just quickly on this, which again hasn't really been well thought through, is in many countries, and in the UK, there's a scheme for furloughing staff, so asking certain people whose jobs seem to be more maybe redundant, or they can be sort of to reduce the financial pressures of the current situation, people are being asked to stop working. And some of those people that have been asked to stop working that we've seen are being IT security people or people whose jobs it is to maintain some of these protective boundaries. So if you are in a company where that's been happening, again, for economic reason, you are actually weakening your controls as well. So that's another factor.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned that vulnerability, because one of the things that is widely discussed from an ethical perspective has to do with data illiteracy, which refers mainly to this lack of knowledge. What you were saying is, you know, we can be aware of things, but sometimes we don't have the skill set to deal with cybersecurity issues when sometimes there is a problem about data management or cyber hygiene. Recognizing important data, knowing the different types of data we're dealing with, how to storage it, etc. So it's quite interesting that you mentioned this, because I think that makes us question. I mean, the pandemic in general has put us in a position to think more broadly about what we're lacking, right? So it seems to me that that data illiteracy is something that should be tackled quite quickly. I mean, a lot of people from different backgrounds, and particularly people dealing with data in any type of context, I think they should worry about having a skill set that allows them to deal with these issues.
No, I agree. And I think a lot of it is, you know, particularly in a corporate environment, you rely on other people to do a lot of that for you. So you rely on IT security people to deal with the security issues. You rely on the HR, you know, different people and different functions to take care of these things. And what we've seen in the pandemic is the rule book has to some extent been torn up a bit, and people are sort of left a bit to their own devices, and they do what they think is appropriate. But if they haven't got, I think this is your point, they haven't got that inherent understanding of the risk, because they just say, well, go on that training course to deal with that process. But if that process has gone away, you don't really understand the underlying risk. So when it hits you in the face, you're not even aware, because you think, oh, well, you know, this looks okay. But of course, that's playing into the hands of many of these hackers and so on, who are sort of recognizing that here's a very vulnerable set of people now who are working in a very unfamiliar environment, and will make decisions that, you know, maybe not prudent, but if they haven't been properly trained and made aware of the risks, then they can't be criticized for the outcomes.
Exactly. There is an issue of allocating responsibility to people that cannot be claimed responsible for something like this, since they don't have the skills. And in the same sort of idea, I would like to talk to you about, you know, some companies have been implementing this thing called Zero Trust, precisely because of these issues. So knowing that they have a lot of workers that maybe do not know how to deal with certain cybersecurity issues that they might face, then they're implementing monitoring systems that create this behavioral profile to ensure the workers' performance. So they sort of know what the employee is doing, at what time and where. And so there is idea of, you know, there is a zero trust. We cannot trust you, because this is, you know, very important. We need to keep data privacy. We need to be secure with this aspect. So that creates, from my perspective, you know, this idea that how can we trust a system that is by definition untrustworthy? So we're, you know, what do you think about that? Is it invading personal privacy? Is it worth, you know, invading that type of personal privacy in order to keep data privacy for the institution, for example?
Sure. No, I mean, it's a great thought, isn't it? I mean, I think that we're all, as we introduce new technologies, there are always new risks, and it's incumbent on the business to understand what those risks are and then to put in place proper controls to manage them. So, you know, for many years we've had, you know, even when the simple things like the internet came along, you know, it wasn't long before companies were saying, hold on a minute, we don't want our employees going on certain websites or downloading certain content. So how are we going to control that? Because we can have a policy, but how do we know people aren't, you know, misusing it or spending their working hours buying stuff on Amazon when they really ought to be sitting at work? So you have a policy that says this is how we expect you to behave. And then over time, you start thinking about, well, how do we make sure that people are actually behaving in line with the policy? So you, and someone says, well, we have a compliance tool that we could use to support you tracking crudely, you know, how people are using the internet or phone calls that they're making and how long they're making or how much money they're spending on these things. So the technologies are always going to be there to do the sorts of tracking, whether it's a simple tracking like that or much more intrusive ones that go into sort of day-to-day, minute-by-minute kind of activity. The question is always from a privacy perspective, well, is that what we call legitimate? I mean, is it proportionate? Is it fair? And is it necessary? I mean, these are all concepts that are baked into things like the GDPR. And are we being transparent to people about how we're doing it? So absolutely, we understand why businesses want to do these things and will do, particularly in an environment like the one we're talking about right now. But they haven't got a free rein to do it. If you look at existing privacy laws, they have to balance out, bluntly, the benefit to the business of doing the monitoring to maintain compliance and protect against risks with the personal intrusion that it might have on the privacy rights of the individuals. And they have to kind of cross this boundary that we talk about of necessity and proportionality and fairness. And so, you know, they should be, and I'm not saying they always do it, but they should be doing a balancing test and looking at these two competing issues and coming up with a what's ultimately a fair structure that sort of says, well, actually, there are these are known to be significant risks, and therefore these aspects of the monitoring are genuinely appropriate and they're not intrusive, and therefore that's okay. But we're not going to stray into this zone over here. But the really interesting thing is different companies in different, particularly different countries and different cultures, will take a different view. So the privacy laws in Europe are reasonably strong in this area and protective. But if you go into other jurisdictions and other countries, then they may not be so. So the sort of the tolerance levels are, you know, socially and legally quite different.
And just wondering about that, just to wrap up this section, what about trust? So there is a whole issue regarding trust. In this case, well, the zero trust thing has to do with, you know, not trusting workers. But there is this general feeling of not trusting technology. What is your perception about how we're dealing with these technologies, the legislation that is coming up, and our relationship with new data-driven technologies?
Yeah, I think... I often give the analogy of, you know, I'm sure when the trains first came out in the 1830s, whenever it was, there were people who thought this is demonic engine that was going to destroy the world. And if you got anywhere near it, it might explode and kill you. And of course, you know, we all knew that, looking with hindsight, you know, 30 years later, everyone's using trains and it's an amazing invention and it's cascading us all around the country and improving you know, communication. So anything that's new that comes along and, you know, is always going to be met with a degree of suspicion. You know, building trust is key, isn't it? Because if people don't trust what you're trying to build and bring, it won't get very far. But equally, when we know whenever new technologies come along, people are suspicious. So it's a really delicate balance. But the truth and the trick is always going to be, and again, this is where, you know, if I look at the laws and the regulations, they're always trying to encourage this, but they're always a step behind. It is to create a framework which says, you know, implement it in a safe way, in a considered way, in a way which helps, particularly concepts of transparency we think are critical, so people really understand both what this technology is, but how it works, how it's been designed, so and be honest about any potential downsides or risks so people know what those are, but also the mitigation. So you're being really clear to people about, look, this is what this is why it's good. We recognize there are these potential issues, but this is how we've addressed it. So you're not trying to hide any of that away and explaining it in simple language that is contextual to the way that people think and understand so they can engage with it. So kind of transparency is always really important. And the other piece that we always look at is kind of governance, so that you've got, if you're saying, you know, we're going to deploy something, you understand what those risks are, but you're also putting in place proper controls to manage them, and that you are actually observing those. So it's all very well and good saying, we think this is a safe piece of technology, and with these protections in place, you know, any risks and concerns you may have about trusting it go away. But you've got to have the governance in place to prove that you're actually going to adopt those controls, and you're going to monitor them and have an independent set of people within the organization, or even externally from the more intrusive stuff, to give assurance that we are doing it properly. And particularly with, you know, some of the kind of the tools that are now being looked at around health, and we may come and talk about this, but the sort of health environment where you're looking at people's health data and how that might be used. People are very sensitive about this information, but if it's managed in an ethically safe and sound way with kind of trusted environments around it, you can achieve great things.
Our interview with Andrew continues in part two of challenges and pitfalls of data privacy during the pandemic. Available now on the IDEA Pod website. The Idea Pod is produced by the Interdisciplinary Ethics Applied Center at the University of Leeds. Find out more at www.leeds.ac.uk/ethics. Music composed and conducted by Josh Armitage.